friendship. What a gift. What a human phenomena. Just stop and think now of your besties, your BFF, best friend forever. Hopefully there are warm, safe feelings that flow through your soul as you think of special humans that share life with you. Unfortunately, true friendship is on the decline. The human connection outside of your blood-sharing family is quite a mystery. But what has been shown repeatedly in the science and empirically is that your friendship circles are so crucial for your ability to thrive. Humans used to significantly consider their social circles when making decisions like moving cities or changing careers, as these would affect their social structure and function. But that's on the decrease, and it's having dire consequences of ill health. Today's podcast is with a special human, John Levy. I'm so happy to have him back because we authentically connect and have fun doing it. John Levy is a behavioral scientist best known for his work in influence, human connection, and decision making. John specializes in applying the latest research to transform the ways companies approach marketing, sales, consumer engagement, and culture. His clients range from Fortune 500 brands like Microsoft, Google, and Samsung. We unpack the critical role of anti-fragility in the human social species and how that skill has atrophied decade by decade since the 1950s, the friendship formula, the fudge factor, and why wealth is not compatible with social bonds, the trade-off between being part of a larger society and the sense of belonging in true community, how a book about an alpha wolf got it all wrong about leadership and being the boss. My big three takeaways from the podcast: number one, true friendship in a safe relationship is to be pursued and valued. Number two, trust is the bedrock of true friendship. Number three, we need each other and no one can do it alone. Please send me your feedback and questions to either connect@made2thrive.co.za or on my WhatsApp direct line 064-871-0308. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Steve Stavs, and this is the Made to Thrive Show. Hello, Thrive Nation. We've got John Levy on the podcast the second time. We're going to link to episode 68, and he is the expert on cultivating influence of connection. He's the behavioral scientist that Made to Thrive is trying to acquire on this scientific advisory board, because this man is a genius. I love his book. He's got a New York Times best-selling book. I think he's writing another one. We're going to get into the details, but welcome back to the show, John.
I am so excited to be back, Steve. I had like a ton of fun with you. And as you know, I try to spend my life getting to interact with people I really find interesting. And it was such a treat. So thanks for having me back.
Brilliant. We got incredible feedback in terms of trust, belonging, and connection. But I do want to just give you my condolences. I know your father passed away. And just tell us the impact it's had on you and what your father taught you about connection.
I think it's important to start with the fact that my father was born in 1940 in pre-Israel Palestine. Poor family. They lived, I think my dad would joke around that they grew up in a house that had 2.5 rooms. There was his mother, his father, and 11 children. And 2.5 rooms was a little excessive. Wow. So his dad would rent out a half room to somebody to make a little extra money.
Crazy.
At night, the girls would, all the girls of the family would line up a bunch of mattresses and sleep across them. He'd share a bed with his brother, and and that's how they would sleep, all in one room. Mm-hmm. That's incredible to me. And he never finished grade school. He got sent to like a school for troubled kids, always caused trouble wherever he was. But what he was capable of, even though he wasn't book smart, was an incredible ability to bring people together. For him, family and gathering was critical. Wow. And he made a career as an artist supporting 4 kids. Sure. He had over 400 shows, 200 one-man shows, which is unheard of.
Wow.
But it was because he would speak to people, even if he didn't speak their language. And so growing up, he would often host like culture nights in our house.
Sure.
And the people there would range from like famous actors like Elliot Gould or like the mayor of Rome, all the way to like a man traveling the world who had nothing that he met at a coffee shop earlier that week. and he wanted to just make sure that they ate a hot meal.
Wow. Sorry, I want to stop you there because the influencers dinner, I mean, was that sort of just totally nurture that led you to do the influencers dinner because you were brought up with a dad who did that and just brought people in and connected with anyone and everyone?
Yeah, he was a pretty extraordinary guy. And I think without a doubt, right? You look at old photos, or if I look at old photos of when my parents would gather people. And when I gather people, the only thing different is the clothing and that I took digital photos, right? But it was like the same kind of stuff. I remember as a child, like they would have an evening where a man would be playing a saw in our living room, or even Allen Ginsberg came one time. I was too young for that, right? I think that was before my time. But he definitely set the tone that for a great life, you need to both bring people together and make sure that they're cared for. And he passed away now, but I think that legacy really lives on.
Brilliant. So let's go into the nitty gritty of connection, because I think, you know, what has changed now, your dad's passed, in terms of human connection with the pandemic and just your feelings with regards to losing your father?
Wow. So that's a big question, right? I think that there's been a real yearning for people. I mentioned this previously that, you know, as societies, we're less engaged than we used to be. It kind of peaked, at least in the US, around 1950, right after World War II, the post-war sentiment started dying down. And what ended up happening was that the television entered the home. So now you could have entertainment at home and you didn't need to join social groups. And I think there's this interesting thing about human beings, in fact, living systems, which is we're anti-fragile. Have you ever come across this concept?
Yeah, absolutely. And Nassim Taleb's anti-fragile. I love it. I love the concept. But explain it for the audience.
Oh, for sure. So, you know, if I have a glass of water and I drop it, it'll shatter, right? Glass is fragile. Then there are things that are robust. Things that are robust are like my building, right? I could bump into my building, nothing's going to happen to it. But there's a third characteristic that we almost never talk about, which is anti-fragility. And anti-fragile things are things that actually get stronger when we apply pressure to them. Mm. So our muscles are the classic example.
Yeah.
We put pressure on them by lifting weights, and over time they get stronger. And that's one of the interesting things about people, is that our social skills, or any skills really, are anti-fragile. Up until a point, when we apply pressure to them, they become better over time. Mm-hmm. And so we came from a culture that was highly interconnected and highly dependent. We needed each other to survive, to collect enough calories and raise our young. And over time, for a whole slew of reasons, we became more disconnected.
Yeah.
And as a result, we've both weakened those skills. When your parents are booking all of your fitness classes for you and you don't have to like hang out with random kids in the neighborhood to play stickball, then you don't have to develop the initiative or develop the social skills to interact with others.
Sure.
And between 1950 and today, we've really, I would argue, our muscles for social interaction have gotten weaker. Sure. Now we've gotten other muscles instead, but one of the big concerns is that the quality of our life really depends on how connected we are to other people, how much of a sense of belonging and community we have. So it's a bit of a concern.
It is. And I know you mentioned a stat that in America, people have got less friends than they used to, I think, since 1980. I think if you can just speak about that stat and what can people do? I mean, they're hearing we isolated now. People are not connecting like they used to. These social skills are underdeveloped, or social quotient, SQ, is probably at its lowest in a long time. The new kids, the new generation are SMSing each other by sitting, you know, 2 feet apart. There seems to be, you know, a real sort of cry and need to help people from a social point of view. You know, give us a message of hope, or where do you see things going in terms of improving these skills?
So I think there's a few things that we need to be aware of. The statistic that you referenced has to do with that in 1985, the average American had just about three close friends besides family. By 2004, 19 years later, we were down to just about two, which means that in less than a generation, we lost, as a country, a third of our social ties, strong social ties. Now, when you look at the fact that human longevity is predictable based on social ties, or that company stock value, employee sick days, or even profitability can be predicted by the level of trust at organizations, then the more we disconnect, the greater it'll have an impact on the quality of our lives. Mm. So with this trend in mind, I think we need to be aware of a few things. The first is that there's always this temptation to take the way that we lived our life and assume that the next generation has to have it the same way, that they need the exact same skill set. Now, in the case of connection, I think that that's one of these that I think is a fair concern because it has an effect on so many other things, right? But just because I grew up in a city doesn't mean, and loved it, doesn't mean that it's best for what my kids are going to experience. And just because my friends grew up in the suburbs doesn't mean that that's what's best for their kids. So I think it's important to separate kind of what's actually important and what isn't. Mm. Now, as far as what I think we're going to be seeing is a higher emphasis on social ties in the workplace. And the reason is that the workplace is one of the few areas that you have to interact with people that you don't necessarily know and or like or could even relate to. Right? You could have like that super awkward friend that all they want to do is talk about like, you know, super technical aspects of weather. And you're like, why are you talking to me? Like, I think it's cool, but like, whatever, right? But you still need to interact with them. And when I think it was a study by Verizon looked at, if you have a best friend at work, you continue to work there. If you didn't, you were really likely to leave. So I think that companies realize that to secure long-term talent, bonuses are important, sure, and like pay and comp is all important. That's nice. But there's going to be a really big pressure on HR and management to ensure that people are connecting to each other in a meaningful way. Mm. Otherwise, the war for talent will go to the companies that have the strongest culture of connection. And we'll also see that those companies that train people to interact will also do better. And the reason is that we're not seeing it in schools. And we can't expect it to come from schools because they're just already maxed out. So one of the reasons that we'll see it is that if the only place you experience connection is at the workplace, you are going to become super judgmental of your workplace the way that you are of your family. And these large companies just don't need that, right? So the Metas, the Facebooks, the Apples of the world don't need more judgment from their people. So they want to have enough social ties inside the company that it makes it a really positive work experience and that you experience belonging. Mm. But that you have enough social ties outside of the company that the only place you get meaning isn't when you show up for work.
Yeah. But is other companies putting their money where their mouths are? I mean, I know it sounds good, you know, that we need good sort of culture. And I know you do a lot of consulting. I'd love to hear about the stats about how you're consulting into these organizations. Are they putting significant money behind formulating an incredibly trusting environment and culture?
So I think that the answer is it's company to company dependent, right? A few months ago, I was at an event. We were a bunch of celebrities and a bunch of business leaders. And we were meeting with members of government to advocate for more arts. And one of the questions posed to this actor is, why do actors keep speaking out about politics? And many of them just sound like complete fools. And should they even be doing this or should they just stick to acting? And his response, I thought, was very eloquent. He said, the expectation that any one industry would have less idiots than any other industry is unfair.
Yeah.
Right. Acting, just like sales, just like medicine, you get this like real range of people who are complete morons to absolutely brilliant geniuses.
Mm.
And I think that the question of, do we see it? Are they concerned? The answer is yes, but there's such a variety of styles and cultures across companies. Mm-hmm. Some companies couldn't care less as long as you produce the result.
Yeah.
Right. Some companies, I just got off of a call with somebody at Roblox, which is this incredible gaming company. And their policy is that they have a long-term view of everything. That's one of their policies. So as a byproduct, if that's really a core value of yours and you live by it, then yeah, you're going to want to really invest into culture because if you're not focused on making profits today, you better have those people engaged for the next 10 years so that you can produce the products that you want. So I think that I'm absolutely seeing it. The issue is that I'm biased because where I'm seeing it is the companies that hire me.
Yeah.
Sure. Right? Like the companies that don't care wouldn't hire me and I'd never come in contact with them anyway.
Okay. Okay. So, but let's talk about, you know, someone's listening and they got kids in terms of social quotient, improving social skills. I know this, you're saying the schools are maxed out. You know, there's obviously now online school happening. You know, my son's at a international university called Henley and he's online and he's missing that interaction doing a finance degree. What can we do for the new generation? My daughter's six now. It seems that, you know, people don't want to prioritize connecting. You know, both parents are often working. That wasn't the case when I was growing up. It was often, you know, a primary breadwinner and there was a lot of social interaction within our community and our suburb. So what can we do, or how can we sort of upskill the new generation?
Perfect. So I think the first thing to understand is that the very first thing is to separate personality types, right? So we don't want to confuse weak muscles for introversion or shyness. So shyness is a concern about being judged. So I don't speak up in a meeting or don't walk up to you to talk to you because I'm just scared that you'll judge me and you'll think I'm stupid or ugly or whatever it is. Shyness is something that you can actually grow out of. Right? Introversion is more, and I'm not perfectly sold on these definitions, but it's more kind of the limit of social energy you have to engage with others. And so if, depending on if it's for me or if it's for my kids, I kind of want to get a base level understanding of, are they introverted, a bit more extroverted? So that way, are they dealing with shyness? That way, I don't just throw them into a scenario that they hate and get traumatized from. Just because I'm a wild introvert doesn't mean you should engage in the same environments. So that's the first thing. Figure out kind of like that bandwidth. The second thing is that human beings tend to connect over common ground. So you want to find a shared interest. Now, for kids, it might be as simple as like, hey, we're going to create a pod of local students that all... go and play in the sandbox together. Sure, that's fine. Like they'll figure out a way to get along to some degree. But it also might be interest-based, right? There's everything from music classes to in New York here, we have basketball leagues and soccer leagues. And my parents would sign me up for it. I frankly didn't really care very much, but like at least it was a shared activity that caused us to bond. So you're either going to find something that you already care about that you share as common ground with somebody. And one of the best places to do that, especially if you're older, I wouldn't recommend this necessarily for little kids, is meetup.com. So meetup.com has, you can either start a group locally or find groups locally that potentially have interest for you, right? So you might find a food meetup and go on a food crawl. You might find a table tennis meetup and make friends over table tennis.
Okay.
But these kind of cultural groups was used to be really the lifeblood of a community, right? It was the bowling league or the knitting club or the book club or whatever it is. The second real option is that you find an activity that causes people to apply shared effort. So what does that actually mean? That means that human beings develop deeper bonds when they have to invest effort into something. So you can either pick something you already have an interest in,
yeah,
or find something that people can invest effort into. It could be volunteer work, could be cooking together, whatever it is that would cause them to invest effort and then care more about each other. But the key is around this common ground, specifically at the scale you feel most comfortable with.
Okay, so common ground is really, really important, and mm-hmm. facilitating areas of interest and possibly meetup.com. And then obviously with children, ensuring that they can, you know, go to an activity that is a joint, you know, activity that they can share. Okay, well, that's fascinating. Meetup.com, we'll check that out. I find that just with, you know, the whole COVID online, people have become a lot more insular, a lot more individualized. Yeah. I think society has moved in that direction. I don't think they value community as much as they used to. So they make decisions to move cities or countries based on careers rather than community, which is, I think it's sort of unfortunately increasing. I know it is here in South Africa.
I would agree very much. You know, it's when that study was looking at why those social ties were breaking down in the US, a large portion of it was because people were moving. Every time we move, we reset mm-hmm. our social ties. Mm-hmm. There's a famous study in the US about a town in where it was mostly Italian immigrants. It was, had hugely dense social ties. People would celebrate every weekend together. And statistically mm-hmm. speaking, based on their diet and how overweight the population was, they should have been dying in their 50s. Our 60s, and they were living to like their 70s and 80s. Yes. And so social behaviors actually protect against other factors.
Yeah.
Now, what happened was when the kids moved away, they tracked the kids, and the kids joined the standard statistics because they no longer had those deep social ties.
Hi, I'm Mate to Thrive Nation. Hope you're enjoying the podcast. If you haven't already, please rate and review the show, as this helps me get this cutting-edge health info into more people's minds and hearts. Also, I'm building a radical health community on Instagram and LinkedIn, so I would so appreciate your support, and send me a DM with any feedback or advice. My handle is Steve Stavs. Thanks again, and now back to the show. But people don't value that, John. They don't really value, they don't value community, they don't value the connections. So they go on in this individualized, and you know, obviously the Western capitalist system is quite a, you know, I think it's the best of the worst. I don't know if Churchill said that, but it just seems that people are, you know, they're neglecting community and connection. And I don't know where it's going to go in the end, because what's happening to health because of that? What's the stats? Give us some behavioral stats in terms of maybe anxiety or depression or, you know, any of these psychiatric disorders.
Absolutely seeing higher rates of depression and the need for like medications and things like that. I don't have all the stats because it's not my specific field, but we're seeing not just an uptick in it, but in the US we're also seeing an uptick in the denial of care, which is even more concerning.
Wow.
So I think it's something like only 10% or something ridiculously low of mental health claims for insurance are actually approved for care. And that's just wild.
That is so crazy.
One of the things that that people, it shouldn't surprise us, but people can actually die of a broken heart.
Hmm.
Right? The level of anxiety that people experience and when they're lonely, and the loss of sleep and the experience of disconnection leads to everything from increased rates of alcoholism and drug abuse to intense loss of productivity at work. And we know this, that when a spouse passes away, the living widow or widower has double the probability of dying for the next year.
Okay.
These things have a profound, profound impact on everything from immune response to general longevity. And researchers looking at women going through breast cancer treatment found that those who, I believe, and I hope I'm not misquoting this, who had significant support structures and communities. I think we're anywhere from 40% to 75% more likely to survive, or something like that.
Brilliant. So let's look at some strategies and techniques within a group. I mean, thank you for answering that for the children, the next generation. I think that's important. And I think that's crucial that people value community. I think a lot of values come from our upbringing, our parents. If they don't value community and friends, they're going to make choices based on finances and compensation and careers more than community. And I think hopefully that'll change, because I think globalization has, you know, changed the dynamic of community. But let's look at, if you're going into a corporate, I'm going into a corporate tomorrow, we're doing, you know, some significant health audits. We're looking at 50% of this executive team, one of the biggest banks in South Africa, had to take long leave in the last year, you know, which is more than 3 months, just because of mental, you know, struggles and that. How do we sort of convince a team in terms of trusting one another, building a culture where they can go forward together from connection? I know you're doing that in a lot of corporates. What are your techniques, or what is your process that you use?
So the first thing I do is I have people realize that many of the things that they think that work to produce their success are completely ineffective.
Wow, that's a big statement. John, tell us, tell me more. Wow.
Okay. And then the flip side of that coin is that there are many things that you aren't doing that if you were, would be far more effective. Sure. So in the traditional model of corporate America, the objective is, I'm going to try and build trust by winning you over. It's pretty simple.
That's true.
Steve, let's talk. I'm going to take you out for dinner. And then hopefully during that dinner, you will like me enough that you will buy my junkie software, my junk, whatever it is, right? My service, whatever I'm trying to hawk on you. And uncomfortable. Right? You're hoping that people's personalities don't clash and that it's an enjoyable experience. Now, there is value to spending time together, without a doubt. But we cannot confuse meaningful connection with pure time, right? Now, there is a model that says you want to be friends with somebody or trusted. The model says you need proximity, you're near each other, duration, length of time, intensity, and commonality, I think it is, right? And so
just repeat that, because I think that's important, trust, because I mean that's what people want to build with one another.
This isn't with trust, it's more like, will we be friends, right?
Okay.
Trust is part of so it's, first of all, you want to be near the person, right? So you want to be in their proximity, you want to spend a lot of time with them. Right? If that time is really intense, it bonds them people more than if, right, if you're going through boot camp, it's very different than if you are both working on a farm and it's like laid back, relaxed environment or something. I don't know if farms are intense. That might be a terrible idea. And then the more you share in common, the more you'll, right? So that's kind of like a model for what causes. And if you want to increase friendship, you can increase any of those factors, right?
Okay.
Or play with them. You can increase intensity, so you both join a really competitive sporting league. That will probably bond you much faster than if you are part of a speed walking club or something like that. I don't know. So, but the first thing is that we really want to break down people's presumptions, right? So they think that, okay, if I buy you a dinner, you'll like me more. Or I'm going to, sorry, you might be able to hear my cat meowing in the background.
No problem.
So the second thing that they might do is, have you ever been to like one of those corporate events where they give you a stupid gift bag with?
Yeah.
What do you do with all that stuff?
Yeah.
Like, let's be honest. You toss it, right? Or you re-gift.
Exactly.
So we're actually devaluing the relationship. But that's kind of how we deal with stuff in corporate America. We say, hey, if you, I want to keep you here. I want you to trust my organization. So I'm going to buy you something on your 2-year anniversary at the company, I'll get you a Starbucks gift card, or like, here's a gift card for some food at TGI Friday. I don't even know what people give. And so the question is, if that really doesn't work, if you can't buy off a relationship, then what does?
Yeah, exactly.
And the answer is that we begin to kind of then expose the things that do. And we kind of touched on these, like the IKEA effect, this idea that when we invest effort into something,
yeah,
like assembling furniture, we care about it more. Us express vulnerability, and the other one recognizes it, which increases trust. There's the pratfall effect. And there are all these kind of characteristics that we break down of how trust actually works.
Yeah.
And then in the process, they begin to see how they need to behave differently. Now, that's the first step. It's having people realize that there's a better option. Now, the next thing we do is then look at kind of what's the culture. Because trusting somebody that doesn't deserve our trust is not a great idea.
Yes.
So the answer isn't just like, let's increase trust. The answer is also, let's make sure that people are deserving of our trust.
Yeah.
And frankly, that's a little bit more complicated because frankly, even the most honest person in the world lies. Everybody does. There's a certain percentage of lies that are just designed for keeping the social fabric together.
Hmm. Wow.
Right. Now, I'm not a huge, like, I have a very low tolerance, but it's important to understand each of us have something called a fudge factor, which is the gap between absolute truth and being seen as a liar.
Yeah. Fudge factor. Did you make that up? Is that your word?
No. It's from Dan Ariely, who wrote okay. Like Predictable
Yeah.
Rapper.
Yeah. I know Dan. Yeah.
And the fudge factor is funny because it can grow and shrink. Like, you're late to go meet a friend and you're technically 5 minutes away, some people's fudge factor would allow them to say, hey, I'm just around the corner, right? I'll be there any minute.
Yeah.
Or I'm just trying to find parking. And they're still a good and honest person. That fudge factor is that distance that you feel creative enough to justify being a good person and you can sleep at night. Now, it turns out that if you think other people are lying, your fudge factor increases. If you have just participated in creative activities, your fudge factor increases because you become more creative in the way you justify things. So everybody lies to some degree. Some could be lies of omission, some could be lies for simplicity, you know, but all these things exist.
Mm.
And some of those lies are like, oh, do I look good in this outfit? I mean, you could tell the absolute truth, or you could have a functional marriage. You can, you know, you decide. Yeah. So, and I'm not here to tell you which to do. Everybody has to decide for themselves.
Yeah.
I'm on the I tell the truth and suffer the consequences side of stuff. But so the question is, how do we deal with trust? And in general, trust is not a logical thing. It's a matter of feeling of certainty. Certainty is an emotion.
Yeah.
Trust generally ends up being as an emotion because it's made up of competence. So, Steve, your ability to do something.
Yeah.
Right? Honesty, that you're telling the truth. And there's that whole fudge factor thing. And then the third is benevolence, that people have your best interests at heart. In general, human beings value benevolence more than the others.
Hmm.
And the reason is that if you don't feel like people have your best interests at heart, it doesn't matter if they're really good at what they do. It just feels kind of terrible interacting with them.
Wow, that's profound. That's profound. And I think benevolence is on the way down, John. It doesn't seem like people really want to see others thrive and, you know, do well in their lives and their families and their kids. Is sort of...
I'm not sure. I'm going to push back on that. I don't know if that's true. I think that we are exposed to television that is full of drama. So we see a lot of examples that are terrible, and the news shares terrible examples. But for our society to function, overwhelmingly, we would need to be outnumbering the bad with good things. Mm.
I hear you, but I just look at, say, we live in a cluster complex in this house here, and we've been, you know, together, married 22 years. What my neighbors used to do for me previously in another complex that I was in is far more. They used to invite us into their home when we came in. No one invites anymore. People don't share spaces easily. They don't, you know, it's just become, you can't come into my space now. We don't go out to do together. It just seems that these general sort of communities that we interact with, whether it's school communities, you know, my son is 18. When he was 6 in grade 0 or grade 1, whatever it is, there was far more interaction between the class moms, the class parents. That seems to have stopped now in terms of helping each other.
How old is your youngest?
She's six. Okay.
And you're saying that there isn't interaction between the class parents? It's
less and less. The parents are under more stress. They're working harder. They don't have time. They're using all pairs. They're using people to sort of, you know, shift their kids around. It's become a society where people are so emotionally exhausted that I think they're looking after their primary needs, or maybe they're doing it, you know, when someone does something for you, but they're only doing it because they're going to have some type of reciprocity. They wouldn't do it because they've got your best interest at heart. And if they don't see that you could actually respond, then we won't do it. So that's my interest. Maybe I'm skeptical, but I'm just looking at a trend from my children, my community of the houses. There's 6 houses that live in this sort of cluster complex. It's sort of like a...
So can I throw out a few possibilities? One is possibility number one, you are absolutely accurate, right? Possibility number two is that people are scared and don't know how to navigate this and would interact if given permission. Meaning that if you said, hey, everybody, I want to arrange for, there's a local park. I'd like to invite all the families to come together. One, would you be interested in? Two, are there dates that work for everybody? Right? You could be the one to bring the community together, as there may have been somebody years before you joined your previous community. Mm. The third is you might be seeing the effects of wealth, meaning that the richer somebody becomes, the less dependent on outside support they become. And so if you look, the poorer the communities, the more sense of actual community. Mm. Because you need it. You can't raise your kid without grandma coming by, or pooling all the kids and one parent does, you know, childcare once a week. You know, there's all these different options. But the problem is that it might just be that you've started earning a lot more. So the people that you're surrounded with have a different social structure.
So maybe you need to define benevolence, John, because benevolence is something that someone has your best interest at heart, but not because they have the best interest at heart because they're going to receive something of reciprocity. Because the random acts of kindness that I used to experience more and
but
more.
But then in that case, they don't have your best interest. If I'm only doing it, so if I'm a salesperson, let's say, and I view things as a long-term relationship, and I come and say, hey, I know you're interested in this bigger car. I know I'd make more of a commission, but I think you'd actually really don't need that much and you'd be better off with a smaller version. I'm saying that because it's for your best interest, but I also know that you will trust me more, be more likely to buy. I don't know if it's just that cut and dry. I don't know if it's that simple. And I think that if I can go so far as to say, there's this, and this is what one of the things my next book is about. There's this impression in our society of what it is to be like our true authentic self, right? Like the way that people view it is like, there's a really good, pure version of me inside. And then there are negative forces on the outside that impact me and influence me to be a worse version of myself. Hmm. Now, what's nice about this is that it's a beautiful narrative. Like there's this pure being in you. The reality is that the neuroscience doesn't back it up. When you speak to neuroscientists, they're more like, oh, it is an all-out royal rumble in your brain of opposing views and interests, fighting it out till one reigns supreme and a decision is made. Okay? There is no pure version in there.
Yeah.
There's all of the versions. There are versions that just want the calories. There are versions that just want to procreate. There are versions that, like, there are all these opposing systems. They all fight each other. And eventually one affects us enough that we go with that decision. And so I don't know if anything's as simple as you're doing it purely for good, purely for bad, purely for me. I think these things are far more complex.
Okay.
And we need to acknowledge that.
Tell me a direct question. And do you think humanity is more kind or they're less kind? Because what I see, kindness is in at a very, very low value in terms of actually people being kind and caring, not to receive something, but just pure kindness.
So I'll say the following. And you live in South Africa, yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to this, but I will say if you approached people in the Black population of South Africa 70 years ago and approached them today, which will express that they've experienced more kindness, my hunch is they would say today. I think that kindness, as inclusion increases, you will see more respect and kindness in general. Now, might that be, like, if you were to compare apples to pure apples, right? Like, you live in a suburb in the United States, and are you talking to more strangers or less strangers?
Yeah.
We might be talking to less strangers.
Yeah.
But we never talked to strangers to begin with. Human beings will do just about anything to avoid talking to a stranger. And it was never a thing that we really did, right? People say, oh, all we do is stare at our cell phones when we're on the train. Yeah. But 50 years ago, all we did was stare at a newspaper. Right.
But you're a behavioral scientist. Surely they got the data on kindness and acts of compassion and, you know, just speaking in the tube. No one wants to talk anymore. I don't know. I remember being in the train in London and we used to talk and there were no cell phones. People didn't have, maybe it was a newspaper, maybe it was a book, but it just seemed that if you're on a train, you speak to this person. Now you're not speaking to them. Now you're not connecting with them. It just, you know, it's, I don't know. Maybe I'm just seeing it wrong.
I do think you're right that, listen, somebody has the data. I'm sure you're right. There are probably people who study kindness and these kinds of things. And there's fantastic research. Most of the research I come across is things like people have very high anxiety levels when it's about talking to strangers, but are overwhelmingly happy when they do. And the conversation goes significantly better than they expected. And then here's the kicker. If you interview each person after the conversation, there's always one person who feels the conversation dragged on longer than it should have, like, or was too, or ended too early. So the length of conversations people want to have never line up.
Yeah, sure.
So I would absolutely bet that you're right, that we approach less strangers. But in terms of, are we better off now than we were at any point in history in general? Across, except for that one thing of civic interaction, right? Like, yeah, we're better off, right? There's probably more in the US people who have friends of different races than at any point in history.
Okay.
I'm Jewish. I would much rather be a part of this society today than American society 150 years ago. Like, I have more rights, I have more respect. It's just a completely different game. So I think
maybe within your own community, you would have a greater trust, you would have greater connection, you would have greater belonging because you needed to, and those things were from
100%.
A social integration wise, you're in a better space. So you're healthier in many ways because your social ties are stronger, your social integration within your community could be far greater. And therefore, you're healthier, you'll get a sort of greater contentment, wellness, well-being.
I think you're absolutely right in terms of, you know, you look at the Amish community of the US, right? Which are generally segregate to some degree. There's varying levels. Some don't use electricity at all. And there's this tradition called the Rumspringer. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of this. It's a tradition where at the age of 16, the members of the society leave the faith for, I believe it's a year, to experience like all of the negatives of normal culture. So they get really drunk and they do drugs and they party their butts off. And what's crazy is that after being exposed to all of that, overwhelmingly, almost everybody comes back to the faith.
Wow.
And I think that it goes to show what you're pointing to, which is that I might be more integrated as a person that comes from the Jewish faith. I'm not religious, but now into American society, and have more opportunities and less racism. But what I may have given up from being part of such a tight-knit community is a sense of belonging and closeness. And I think that there's absolutely something to that. Mm. That, you know, there are trade-offs between being part of a larger society and being part of a smaller community. And what's probably healthiest for us is to have access to one, not experience racism or prejudice, but to feel a true sense of belonging with. And you'll see how far people will go. In the Mormon faith, people will deny their sexual orientation and pretend to be straight just so that they can continue to be part of the community. And that's kind of a wild testament to how important it is for us to belong.
Yeah, it's very, very powerful. And I think that's the problem, is that if we, you know, people say, I don't care what people think, but there's certain people you should really care about what they think. Your close community, your close friends, your close family, those are the people that you actually care about, you know, what they think about you and who you are and reflect. And then the rest of the world with globalization and social media, maybe you shouldn't be caring about what they think or say. So it's quite a sort of dichotomy of multiple communities who might have greater rights in the greater sort of, you know, populace or the greater world. But it seems like we've lost a very, very closeness and intimacy that I think all human beings need. So fascinating. Tell us, are we able to make a comment on that, and tell us about your new book, if it's possible?
Oh, I'm working on a new book right now. I'm happy to tell you a little bit about it.
Good.
But it's not, not the main book I'm focused on right now is You're Invited, The Art and Science of Connection, Trust, and Belonging, which you mentioned was the New York Times bestseller and all. Project I'm working on right now is, what did we get wrong about what we think makes us effective?
Tell us.
So there are all these kind of, you know, theories to, oh, if you want to be an amazing boss or leader, you have to act in a certain way. You have to be the alpha male, like all these things. And so I came across this insane story, like just completely wild, where a researcher, I believe it was in the 1970s, went out and, researched the behavior of wolves. And he found that there's almost always one or two leaders to every
pack.
Yeah, to every pack. And so he wrote a book about the alpha wolf or the alpha male, and it became wildly popular. And in the process, it kind of took hold in corporate America, and people took on this view like, I'm going to be the alpha. I'm going to dominate everybody. So years later, the researcher looks back and checks, you know, tries to reproduce his study. And it turns out he was completely wrong. What he thought was the alpha was actually just the parents. It was the parents and the cubs, and they were naturally leading them as good parents. And so what ended up happening is that nobody wanted to listen to him. Nobody wanted to accept the correction. And so we got stuck with this view of like, I'm going to come into a negotiation. I'm going to demand everything I want. Mm-hmm. And you're going to give it to me because I'm more intimidating than you. But the research really shows that the people who are more amenable, the people who are friendlier, the bosses that aren't super intimidating are the ones that do much better. Mm-hmm. And so that's just one of many kind of misnomers. And I want to kind of shatter what we've gotten wrong.
Wow.
And kind of set the record straight on a lot of these things.
So what does the project entail, John? How are you sort of facilitating or sort of working with it?
I'm going around trying to understand right now what people think makes them effective. And then I'm actually going and checking what the research says and seeing if people are right or wrong. And we'll probably do a few of our own studies. But it's kind of just one of these wild things that, like, we keep thinking something works and it overwhelmingly doesn't.
So what are the top three variables that you found? I mean, is amenable one of them? Is that as a boss, or is that sort of one of the most important things to be effective?
It's in general, you want people to feel safe enough that they can tell you anything. right? Because otherwise nobody's going to report a problem. They're going to keep telling you, oh, everything's great, everything's great. And then you're one day going to find out that everything's not great. And that's going to be a real problem. So if you hear a lot of problems being reported, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing. At medical institutions, when there's a lot of reports of error, it often means that there's a high level of trust that people won't be fired.
That's true.
And so the places that had lower reporting didn't have less mistakes. They just had less trust.
Mm. Wow. That's incredible. So safety is number one. Is that the bedrock? Yeah. Is that the foundation? Safety.
I think that the bedrock is having a clear understanding of what the objectives are and a level of trust and integrity that so that people can communicate. Without those two things, you don't know where you're going or the values by which you're getting there.
Hmm. Okay. Brilliant. Sounds exceptionally interesting. I'd love to hear more. You know, we're coming to the end of the show, just value, just your humor and your perspective on life and community and connection and trust. I think my view is this is a very, very low value out there. And I think across communities, it's something that we need to try and fester and upskill and model. Mm-hmm. I think if we can model it with our, you know, I think of the Jewish community here on a Friday night, Shabbat dinner is something that many of them still do, still value, still spend time. And so I think we need to model that and really, really try and help society. I think intimacy is based on a lot of those variables that you said. So I just want to thank you for your work. I know that you went through sort of your own health journey. Are you well? Or, you know, how's John doing?
I was laid up because of COVID, and it was a bit of a journey of months of recouping. So thank you very much. I appreciate that. And yeah, I think I agree with you that we are in a situation where we need to really build the muscle to connect better and to put ourselves out there. I know it can be scary. I know we can feel like our skills have atrophied, but the positive benefits far outweigh the occasional like misfires. Mm. And I think that that's what we really need to learn.
Brilliant. Also, the influencers dinner, is that continuing, John? Are you still in the process?
Yep, just did dinner 266 across. Now we're in 11 cities and 4 countries. None yet in South Africa, but hopefully I get the invite out there one day.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. We'd love to have you over and, you know, obviously look at the structure and the process if you're willing to come. I think it's crucial. And I think when you do have dinner in your home, dynamics do change. I think you do build something which is exceptional. So well done to you. Congratulations. And just want to declare favor and blessing over you again, John Levy, and condolences to your father. He seems like he was an incredible man that taught you many things. You've overcome health challenges and now you're looking at a new book. And just thank you so much.
This has been a treat. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Made to Thrive show. New episodes are released weekly and are published exclusively on the Made to Thrive podcast link. If you're interested in receiving more thriving insights, as well as receiving other exclusive member benefits, visit madetothrive.co.za/subscribe. This podcast is for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of healthcare professionals for any such conditions.